rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Cochran, Judge Hal Brooks. The Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is July 11, 2023. This panel of the court today is gathered in courtroom 200. We have three cases set for oral argument. The first case set for oral argument is number A22-1773 in the matter of the trusteeship created by the Volusia County Industrial Development Authority related to and so on. I think you know the case. Counsel, I assume you're familiar with our procedures. Each of you, well, appellant will have 15 minutes for its initial argument. Respondents then have 15 minutes to allocate among themselves. Has there been an agreement between you?
Yes, Your Honor. We've noted to the clerk how we will allocate the time.
And what is that allocation?
5 minutes for U.S. Bank and then 10 minutes for the senior bond.
Okay, thank you. And then appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Okay. If counsel are ready, appellant's counsel, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Greg Fishbein, and I represent the appellant Preston Hollow Community Capital, LLC, in this matter. Preston Hollow is the owner of third-tier Series 2017C subordinate bonds in the amount of $2,300,000. This is an appeal about contract interpretation. The court must decide whether the net sales proceeds should be distributed to all bondholders on a pro rata basis or distributed in priority order, first to senior bondholders, then to second-tier bondholders, and then to third-tier bondholders. Preston Hollow believes that the governing documents in this case require that the net sales proceeds be distributed on a pro rata basis. Here, there is no disagreement amongst the parties that a foreclosure would have resulted in a pro rata distribution. There is also no disagreement that certain facility sales would have resulted in a pro rata distribution. And there is no disagreement that certain mandatory redemptions would result in a pro rata distribution. To be clear, all of the parties agree that there was not a judicial foreclosure in this case. Instead, there was a liquidation of the underlying collateral. It was a short sale, a distress sale that was done for less than the amount of the debt. There is also no question that Preston Hollow holds subordinate bonds, a series of them. Those subordinate bonds receive a higher rate of interest than the senior bonds, and they have a lower priority on certain distributions, and on others, as I have noted, they have an equal right of distribution. Our view is that Section 5.9 of the loan agreement provides how the sale proceeds should be distributed in this case. That section governs the sale of facilities, and it explicitly overrides the terms of the trust indenture, specifically sections 803A and 803B. When there has been a sale of the facilities, Section 5.9C of the loan agreement requires that the net proceeds be deposited into the respective special redemption accounts and paid out in accordance with Section 313 of the trust indenture.
Mr. Fishbein, let me interrupt you right there. So Section 8.02 of the indenture is entitled Remedies. I mean, do you agree that the trustee followed the procedures set forth in 8.02?
Yes, I think that the issue that we have was with the actions that were taken after the district court entered its December 8th, 2021 order. But generally speaking, yes, we would agree that the 802 provisions were followed. And 803...
Can you be more specific about the issues you have with events that occurred after that December order?
Well, the December 8th order was the order that authorized the sale to take place and allowed the release of the mortgage and the release of liens and the security interests. It specifically provided that order of the court approving the sale and requiring the holding of the sales proceeds did not grant any bondholder any right or interest in the funds other than what would be determined by further order of this court. And that order said specifically that the holding of the sales proceeds would not prejudice or impair any argument made or to be made. The issue that we had, which we raised with the district court, contrary to what respondents argued, was that the notice of acceleration that took place after that order was an attempt to give them the benefit of proceeding in their view under 803B instead of 803A. And that's certainly where we take exception. Now, given our position, that really ultimately doesn't matter because...
Can you say that again? Are you referring to 803 or 802?
No, I'm referring to 803.
Can you repeat that statement, please? I'm sorry.
Yes, the...
It's your position that the acceleration...
The notice of acceleration, which is what allowed, according to respondents, the distribution to be done under 803B, had that notice of acceleration not taken place, their position would have been that the distribution would be pursuant to 803A. We argue that that really is, yeah.
How would that affect the distribution if it was under A versus B?
Well, I think that as I understand respondents' position, I'm not sure it would have affected that. Our position is instead you don't go to 803, whether it's 803A or 803B.
Okay, thank you. That was my understanding as well. I just wanted to be clear on that.
Yes.
Then, is your question been answered, Judge Johnson?
Yes, yes.
I was thinking of turning to the language of 5.9, which is the focus of your argument.
Correct.
And that language specifically talks about, says the borrowers may sell any separate facility constituting part of the project, but only if A, B, and C.
Yes.
And as I read your brief, I think your argument is that the project consists of Woodland Towers. So it's not clear to me how the sale of Woodland Towers is the sale of a separate facility constituting part of the project, because it talks about part of the project, but as I understand your brief, the sale of the facility was the sale of the whole project.
Yes, that is correct, and I think that language needs to be read in conjunction with some of the other provisions that I think allow for a partial sale. And what we argue in our brief is Section 3.13 of the trust indenture, which is captioned Special Redemption Upon Sale of Facilities. And it talks about sales proceeds. And 313 provides that a mandatory redemption in whole or in part proceeds pursuant to Section 5.9. And what we have identified here is the definition of sales proceeds specifically says that sales proceeds are defined as the proceeds from the sale of one or more of the facilities that are part of the project And that's on page 26 of the indenture, that definition. And our argument is that there is no question that the sale was of one of the facilities that is part of the project.
But it still uses that language, part of the project.
Well, but it says one or more. So when it talks about one, this is the one. There wasn't a more. So we're arguing that the definition that contemplates one is in the definition of sales proceeds. And
so, assuming we were to agree with that, you still have under 5.9, it says borrowers may sell any separate facility constituting part of the project, but only if A, B, and C. And I think the district court found that at least B wasn't satisfied. Can you address that part
Yes.
of the language?
Yes, I think that our argument there is that the forbearance agreement and the amended forbearance agreement, which was in effect at the time, would be the provisions that would have allowed for the continuing during this time period and would make those not applicable. The forbearance agreement was expired on May 14th of 21, and then there was an amended forbearance agreement on August 30 of 21. And the other thing that's consistent with our reading of the definition of sales proceeds as it is.
Can I go back to your answer to that question? Do the forbearance agreements make specific reference to paragraph B, the requirement about debt service coverage ratio?
I don't believe that they did, but I believe that they were, in essence, the provisions that allowed the continuation of the project at the time when everything was in default. So I don't think that there's a specific reference in either of those agreements to 5.9, B, or C, but it's our position that it was the overriding guideline for how things were proceeding by the parties with respect to the defaults to allow the continuation of the business at this point.
And then did the forbearance agreements expire at some point?
Well, I think that the first one had an expiration date, and the second one, I think it just expired with the sale of the property. I don't specifically know that, but that's my recollection, is that once the sale was consummated, that was no longer applicable. There were just sales proceeds at that time. There wasn't any sort of income from operations, or as we talk about project revenue, which I'd also like to get into how we think that the use of that term project revenue and what's excluded from it applies. Now, first, we need to look at the definition of sales proceeds, which is also in the indenture and I think is also important. And project revenue. Project revenue, the discussion on what project revenue includes and excludes, some of that is in the indenture and it is also in the official statement, which we cite, pages 16 to 18 of our opening brief. And there, project revenue specifically excludes money that is derived from the sale of assets that is not in the ordinary course of business.
Mr. Fishbein, excuse me, but can you orient me, why is the term project revenue relevant to your argument? Where does that appear, in which section?
Well, our argument is that the money that is to be distributed through section 8.3 is project revenue, that's what the money that gets paid out is the collection of what is project revenue. And throughout the indenture, there are exclusions for what is distributed through Section 8.
And so is that term project revenue used in 8.03?
Well, I think that's an issue raised by the parties. That word is not in the Section 8.03, but I believe that when you read what is being distributed, that is what project revenue is.
So you are equating project revenue with sales proceeds?
Well, what I'm saying is that project revenue excludes sales proceeds. And so that supports our argument that the money that is distributed through 803, which is when there has been a default, but there is money coming in that just is not enough to satisfy what is due, that money that's being distributed is project revenue. And there are certain things excluded from that because they're covered in other sections. And that's the point here, is that project revenue also excludes money that is being distributed either through Section 313 or because it is a mandatory redemption. Again, I don't think there would be a dispute that if you're in that situation, that money is excluded from what gets distributed in the 803 in a default situation because it is specifically provided for under another section and is distributed under the terms there, not under 803. So,
And to be clear, 803, the subject of 803 is funds derived from actions taken in connection under a senior bonds event of default, correct?
When there has been a default, that is correct.
And the actions taken, pursuant to that term are in 802, and specifically 802A, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I see that my time has expired, so I will sit down now and respond to other arguments.
Okay. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, next, counsel for the first respondent. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may proceed. Right. I should have mentioned at the beginning that our lectern is adjustable with a button at the front edge and an electric motor, but Mr. Binman is familiar with that. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jevin Binman, and I represent respondent U.S. Bank National Association as trustee. The sole issue presented by this case is whether the district court correctly determined that the trustee should allocate funds from the sale of the property first to the senior bondholders and then to the second and third tier bondholders using the waterfall distribution in Section 8.03B of the trust indenture. Because the district court correctly applied the unambiguous language of the trust documents, it should be affirmed. Now, in my short amount of time, what I'd like to do is have a high-level overview of the trust indenture and the various sections that we're talking about here. I'll start with Article 3, which is titled Redemption or Purchase of Series 2017 Bonds. And as counsel for appellant has pointed out, Section 5.9 of the loan agreement is incorporated by reference into some of these sections. Now, Article 3 is talking about calls for redemption of a portion of the bonds. There are various payment plans that are described in Article 3. And it's clear that Article 3 is referring to a healthy project where redemptions are occurring in the ordinary course of business. That is not what occurred here. In March of 2020, the borrower stopped making its debt payments. The trustee provided a notice of default in July of 2020. And then we proceeded not in Article 3, where you would have ordinary course redemptions, but in Article 8, which is titled Defaults and Remedies.
So when you say Article 3 is clear that it applies in ordinary course redemptions, what specific provisions are you relying on?
Well, the provisions, just generally in Article 3, it's talking about the payments that the borrower would make throughout the course of the project. And in particular, if we're looking at Section 3.13 of the indenture, that is discussing payments made after the sale of a portion of the facilities, which is the language that 3.13 uses. And the only way that works is if there are remaining portions of the project with which the borrower can continue to make its to pay its debt obligations. And there's no dispute here that that did not happen. The sale was for the entire project, and it was at a price that was less than the amount of the outstanding bonds. So what that means is there was no opportunity for the buyer, for the borrower, to continue to make its debt payments. We talked about Section 5.9B of the loan agreement regarding the debt service coverage ratio. And again, the intent of that provision is to make sure that the borrower can continue to make its payments even if a portion of the project is sold. And here, the entire project was sold. There was nothing left to continue to make payments. That's one of the many reasons that Section 5.9 is inapplicable here. And where we should be living is in Article 8. 8.01 discusses what constitutes a senior bonds event of default. There's no dispute that that occurred here. 8.02 discusses the senior bondholder's right, 25% of the senior bondholder's right, to instruct the trustee how to proceed in order to protect the rights of the senior bondholders. And again, there's no dispute that that occurred here. In March of 2021, the senior bondholders directed the short sale of the property. And then the question in this case is, what do you do next? And the trustee believes, and the district court agreed, that you go to 8.03. 8.03A applies to situations where the debt acceleration has not occurred. 8.03B applies where a notice of acceleration has occurred. But in either case, there would still be a waterfall distribution that would go first to the senior bondholders and then to the lower tier bondholders.
Mr. Binman, what 802A and B seem to be alternative remedies. What determines whether the trustee takes action under A or under B?
802A and B?
Correct.
802A is more of a general statement that upon the direction of 25% of the senior bondholders, that the trustee can proceed to act in the to protect the rights of the senior owners. 802B is if the senior bondholders direct a foreclosure, then the trustee is required to proceed down that route. Now, there's no dispute that
toward foreclosure,
and there's no dispute that that did not occur here.
So, is it theoretically possible that different groups of senior bondholders might request both?
It might be theoretically possible, Your Honor. It's undisputed that it didn't happen here, so we don't have to determine how that would be figured out. But here, the senior bondholders instructed the trustee to proceed under 802A.
Appellant's counsel made reference to the acceleration that was noticed after the December order. What was the consequence of that acceleration?
For purposes of determining distribution, there was none. If you look at 803A, which is the provision that determines distribution if the debt had not been accelerated, that also requires a waterfall distribution. This is on page 10 of Respondent's Addendum. It says, if the principal of all the senior bonds has not been declared due and payable, so there's no acceleration, first, the payment goes to the senior bonds. Second.
And then B, 803, I'm just sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead, yes.
But to save time, 803B applies if the senior bonds have been declared due and payable.
Correct. And the same waterfall distribution would apply, first to the senior bonds and then to the second and third tier bonds. I see my time has expired. The trustee would respectfully request that the decision of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the other respondent on appeal may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, I am Eric Sherman, appearing today for senior bondholders Forces Opportunities 1, LLC, and Birch Creek Credit Value Fund. Among the many arguments that have been mentioned today, one is conspicuously absent. No one is here advocating that the indenture is in any way ambiguous. And as a consequence, there can be only one reasonable interpretation of the indenture and the other bond documents. Preston Hollow purchased bonds labeled third tier, relying on an official statement that contains multiple bold-faced warnings about how risky and how, quote, highly speculative, end quote, they are. Those bonds provide on their face that they are subordinate to the series of bonds called senior and second tier, and Preston Hollow even calls their bonds subordinate and the transaction highly leveraged in its own brief. Both the normal course waterfall contained in Article 5 of the indenture and the default waterfalls contained in Article 8 put the third tier bonds behind the second tier and senior bonds in priority of payment. So the court is called upon to ask itself which interpretation is the reasonable one, the one that accords third tier status to third tier bonds, or the interpretation advanced by Preston Hollow, which would pretend that the different classes don't exist. Now, I want to address first this acceleration piece and kind of get it out of the way because I regard it as somewhat of a red herring. The district court's initial order in this case permitted, with the consent of all parties, including Preston Hollow, the sale transaction to go forward and then set aside the proceeds in a pot and made provision that that action of setting aside the funds would neither increase or decrease the rights that any party had under the indenture and under the bond documents. Well, one of the rights that the senior holders have in this case under the indenture is to direct the trustee to accelerate the bonds. And there was nothing in the district court's order. Preston Hollow points to nothing in the district court's order that prohibited that direction by the senior holders. And indeed, when you think about what an acceleration is, we have bonds here that have a schedule of payments out years into the future, but those payments are not being made. The issuance is in default. The only income-producing asset in the trust is being liquidated down to a pot of money. It is difficult to see how you could avoid accelerating the payment schedule for the bonds when there is no longer an income-producing asset in the trust. Here, the district court entered its order approving the sale transaction, allowing it to go forward, and within a matter of days, the senior holders issued their direction to accelerate the issuance to allow the disbursement of the sale proceeds once the sale could be completed. And Preston Hollow does not explain how that acceleration piece could really have been avoided, given the circumstances. And to the extent that, and I agree with Trustees Council that really because of the waterfalls in subsection A versus subsection B of section 8.03 of the indenture, because they both call for priority distribution first to senior holders, there really is no consequence to the distribution of funds. But even if that action of accelerating the bonds did in some way benefit the senior holders, my response is, so what? The trustee is contractually bound to act solely for the benefit of the senior owners when there are any senior bonds outstanding. And so the senior owners were contractually entitled to take actions permitted by the indenture to benefit themselves, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
I'm unclear as to why acceleration was necessary if the borrowers had agreed to a voluntary sale.
Well, the acceleration piece is taking the payment schedule for the bonds, which would extend years into the future, and saying all that debt is due to the holders right now, which makes sense. When you don't have an asset that is going to produce income over time, you have liquidated that asset down to a fund, which unfortunately is not.
Sorry to interrupt, but without that without the notice of acceleration, were the borrowers permitted to prepay all of the, or to make full payment of all interest and principal?
In Article 3 of the indenture, there are certain circumstances under which the borrowers could redeem the issuance. And really, I think perhaps something that's being overlooked here is that, you know, the indenture, as we discussed in our brief, makes provisions for good economic times, and it makes provisions for bad economic times. Article 8 is a provision for bad economic times, and bad economic times is what happened to Woodland Towers here in 2020 in the middle of the global pandemic, as happened so many other places. Article 3, allowing for redemptions, is really a provision to address good economic times. If it suits the borrower to, let's say the project appreciated as opposed to depreciated over time, if it suits the borrower to sell a portion of the project, or perhaps to sell it and lease it back, there are any number of combinations of things that could have happened, then Article 3 allows them to do that. And what Section 5.9 of the loan agreement and Section 3.13 of the indenture do in that instance is, because the collateral roll is shrinking, you have to shrink the debt as well. And the reason you do that pro rata is because you want the holders in the various tiers to keep their relative risk-reward positions with collateral that is now smaller. That is why Section 5.9 specifically addresses sales of a part, or as it's termed in Section 3.13 of the indenture, a portion of the project. Really, all you are doing is allowing the borrower to capitalize on an opportunity to sell some portion of the collateral and then shrinking the deal proportionally among the various holders. Your Honor, when the appellant conceded that the trustee was proceeding under Section 8.02 of the indenture, that's really a dispositive concession, in my view, because if what follows from that is if the trustee is exercising default remedies, as you noted, Section 8.03 of the indenture applies specifically to funds derived from actions taken in connection under a senior bonds event of default. So when appellant concedes that the trustee, by engaging in the short sale, was operating under Article 8 of the indenture to address a default, that's really the case right there, because that triggers Section 8.03, and because the bonds have been accelerated, you look to subsection B to distribute the proceeds. For all the reasons I've mentioned, there could have been no sale under Section 5.9 of the loan agreement in this case because, again, as Judge Cochran observed, none of the conditions were met in that section of the loan agreement. And when that section begins by saying, notwithstanding anything herein or in the indenture to the contrary, that doesn't vitiate the internal limitation of the Section 5.9. What it does is clarify that if those conditions are met, then that section may override other provisions of the bond document. Because for the very reason that the issuance was in default, you could not have a debt service coverage ratio of greater than one, and so you absolutely cannot have a sale under Section 5.9 of the loan agreement.
Just so I'm clear, Mr. Sherman, if in the event that the trustee, or if the trustee had proceeded under 802B toward a foreclosure, do we still then follow 803A, or do we follow 803B or some other provision for distribution?
Well, Your Honor, I think We would concede that if there was a foreclosure here, and in the state of Florida there are only judicial foreclosures, and all parties agree there was not a foreclosure here, then Section 8.07 of the indenture would apply. But there was no foreclosure here, and so that section of the indenture cannot apply.
So the reality is that the senior bondholders or a controlling group of 25% or more can determine whether the trustee takes this goes down this path or this path, and they lead to different distribution schemes.
Well, I think if you read Section 8.02B in its entirety, what it addresses is what happens if a foreclosure is commenced and then the mortgage is reinstated. And so that subsection is more specific to the foreclosure remedy. But as far as the rights of the senior holders, yes, the senior holders have an absolute right under the indenture to direct the trustee in its exercise of remedies to address a default, because the only default that can exist while senior bonds are outstanding is a senior bonds event of default. There's just simply no right in junior holders to direct the trustee in any exercise of remedies.
Can you address from your point of view, your perspective, my previous question to Mr. Binman about the hypothetical, if two different sets of bondholders owning 25% give directives to the trustee, you know, under that are conflicting pursuant to 802 A and B, then what?
I think, Your Honor, candidly, that's a more difficult case. I agree with Mr. Binman that it is not our case. I think the trust instruction procedures in Chapter 501C of the Minnesota statutes would be available, and that matter would come before a district court judge to try to sort out.
Okay. I was wondering if there was an easier answer, but than what appears, but it sounds like there's not.
Yeah, Your Honor, candidly, it's not something I had considered before you raised it today, and
it's funny that the word controlling is used for a group that is less than 50%, but. And I guess the word controlling is perhaps used in the briefs, not in the indenture. But okay, I interrupted you. Anything else?
No, and I see my time has expired. So if there are no further questions, I'll take my seat.
There are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Sherman.
Thank you,
Mr. Fishbein. You have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to start with the concession that counsel is arguing, and I want to make clear what happened in the December order. The December order of the court allowed the sale to proceed. Preston Hollow came in and objected to the petition, which had suggested distributing in the way that they're talking about. Preston Hollow came in and objected, and the decision was, and the court ordered, that the sale could proceed and that the proceeds would be held until further order of the court directing when and how distribution will be made. There's no concession. There's an agreement that the way to proceed, which is why the petition was brought, is through a sale under 802A. The direction was received, but there has never been a concession, and the court explicitly acknowledged that the distribution issue would be decided at a later time. Now, again, this is clear in the briefing.
So, I had a similar question or a similar thought, and that is that, you know, once the trustee has gone down the path of what I'll call 802A, and then borrowers agree to a sale, and then once the district court approves that, isn't sort of the die cast? I mean, then
absolutely not.
It seems like the transaction has been approved, it seems like then there are fewer, perhaps only one alternative for distribution rather than multiple.
Well, that's not what the district court held in December. And the district court said there is a dispute here. One side suggests this way to distribute, the other side suggests a different. I'm going to decide it later. It did. And as we point out, This is a de novo review. It is correct that all parties believe that the terms of the governing documents are not ambiguous, but we can't both be right, right? We both believe that we have a reasonable interpretation. And to the extent the court believes, based on those arguments, that there is ambiguity, then we suggest you look at the parole evidence, which here would be the official statement. And we've identified what we believe is important from the official statement that gives meaning to the terms to support our interpretation. I do want to address, because it hasn't been discussed yet, Section 807, which you asked briefly about, that deals with foreclosures. Now, I agree with this interpretation about good times, bad times, and Section 8 deals with bad times, and there's no dispute that if there had been a judicial foreclosure, we'd be distributing this money in a different way. But our argument is that 807 should not be read so narrowly to apply only to a judicial foreclosure. And we introduced evidence in district court that talked about how the realities have changed now in the commercial markets, and that there are things other than foreclosure done in bad times. You have things like deeds in lieu of foreclosure, a receivership sale, bankruptcy. There are a whole host of other realities that are used to deal with the bad times. And again, our argument is that in those situations where you, in essence, are selling everything off, shutting everything down, if it's a foreclosure, there's no question it's a pro rata distribution. And our claim is that that's the same scenario that should apply to the short sale, because it is, in essence, a foreclosure. Everything is sold, the money is being distributed, and the project is being shut down. So we believe that when you look at those circumstances in conjunction with the language that we have focused on with respect to what the operating statement talks about, what are sales proceeds, what is project revenue, that's the construct that we think supports our interpretation. In good times, you distribute priority order. There's no question about that. In bad times, it's a different scenario. In bad times, when there is still project revenue coming in, but there's a default and you're trying to continue operations, you have 803. Aside from that, when you're wrapping up the project and there is a sale of the facilities, there's a short sale, everything is done, we believe there should be a pro rata distribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fishbein. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.